Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. Now, here are your hosts, Corey and Mason.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Mason Schmidt, here with my best bud, Corey Knutson.
Ew.
And we're going to talk about new releases, both from this last week and also what we have looking to look forward to, which we are recording today on a Monday, so we have a bit of a shortened week. We'll also talk about physical media releases coming out this Tuesday, which is tomorrow, and then other notable developments within the world of movies. But Corey, how you been, and what are we going to be sipping on today?
Doing good. Got a little Coors Banquet today.
Yeah.
In honor of what we're going to be mainly talking about, The Black Phone. We both rewatched the movie this week, and I had forgotten that the opening shot of that movie is somebody cracking open a Coors Banquet at a kid's baseball game.
And it's like the nice, like, just cylindrical flat top cans with, like, the little punch out. Oh, it's so cool.
Miss that. Good old, what, 70s vibes in that movie.
78, I think, is when it takes place.
So, what better way than to down some Colorado Kool-Aids of our own?
I've never heard them called that, but that's fitting.
Oh, it's beautiful. The cans... fucking beautiful too. Love this
shit. Nasty Dijon mustard colored can.
Something about it, man.
It's special. This is something perfect.
This is really special. But anyways, yeah, we got a lot to talk about this week, so we're gonna jump right in with a couple Black Phone movies.
Yeah. So I've only seen Black Phone, the original one from 2022, just one time. It was when I saw it in theaters, and then I was like going into Black Phone 2, which I started to get really excited about. I knew I had to go back and watch the first one, which I ended up watching at work during a slow day. I just put it on one of my prompters at work and just, boom, good. Happy to watch that.
Corporate America.
Corporate America is great. It's still, like, a lot of the issues I have with this movie are still there, but I do overall really enjoy this film. Obviously coming from director Scott Derrickson, who did the first Sinister, which is one of Corey's favorite films, and maybe I think it's your favorite horror film.
Mm-hmm.
He also did Exorcism of Emily Rose, which is my favorite film of his. This is starring Mason Thames, Madeline McGraw, Ethan Hawke, and Jeremy Davies. And it's just about the grabber, this man that's abducting children and killing children in the 70s. And I think the premise works. I think the story works. I love most of the characters. I think the thing that kind of just grates on me over time is some of the performances by the child actors isn't always the most convincing for me. I also think there's some weird tonal shifts in the movie that I don't love or appreciate, and I think that there's a couple of shoehorned comedic elements, especially Ethan Hawke's brother, that character within the first movie. So overall, like, it's still, I don't love it, and I know a lot of people really love this movie and see it as, like, one of the best horror films of the 2020s. I'm like, yeah, it's fine. It's good for being, like, a mass-marketed horror film. Like, I think it works on that aspect. And I love the iconography of the grabber and the black balloons and all that. I think it works great. Still, just a lot of my issues that I had originally kind of still ring through. But every once in a while, I just want to rewatch this movie, even though I don't absolutely love it. So it's kind of infected me a lot. And also, it being October, that probably helps it out a little bit, too. But Corey, what's your thoughts on the first Black Phone?
I'm pretty similar to you. I'd only seen it the one time in theaters, and rewatching it this week. Yeah, I mean, I think it is really solid. Ethan Hawke is really fun as the grabber, kind of doing a villain role, which he normally doesn't do. And I like Mason Thames a lot in the movie. Yeah. I think he's, for a child performance, really good. You mentioned some of the other ones can sometimes get a little hit or miss, but I think he's really strong. And I think the thing I appreciate is just the simplicity of it in this, mainly this one dungeon. And he's getting the calls from all the previous kids who were there. And I like that he uses a little bit of what each kid, like, did before, whether it's, like, a piece of string that they had or, like, a hole they started digging. And it kind of all comes back and comes to a head at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and you can see all that advice just work into his, like, master plan, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and yeah, I mean, I love the late 70s feel of Denver. It's just a cool, kind of cozy environment in a weird way. And I love the use of, like, the 8mm film to show, like, flashbacks or if somebody's having a dream or anything like that. It just really puts you in a time and place. You got the Coors Banquet, like we mentioned, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I enjoy that movie. Like you, I don't think it's one of, like, the top tier horror movies of this decade. I think it's really good. I enjoy watching it, and it, you know, helps, like you said, kind of be in October too and giving it a rewatch.
Yeah, and some of the child actors or child performances in that first movie don't work for me. Madeline McGraw does work for me, and we'll talk about her in the second one as well. I think she and her performance and Ethan Hawke's performances are the two big takeaways from both movies for me that I'm like, yep, these are the characters I really love. Also, this is kind of like a nitpick positive in a way. The movie opens, obviously, with a beautiful shot of the Coors Banquet, but then a baseball game where Mason Thames' character Finn is pitching. And he is throwing a count, and he's going up against this other kid in his school, and you can feel, like, the intensity of that moment, and I think he's facing two strikes, and then, boom, rattles it out of the park. And you feel like, in that moment, I'm supposed to hate that kid, because then he is rounding the bases, he's like, you almost had me. And then it just later develops into, like, oh, no, like, he's actually nice to him. Like, they're a friendship, and this isn't, like, a bully character. I feel like the first time I watched it and then rewatching it this time, I was waiting for that character to be a complete asshat to Finn. And I was like, oh, this is kind of refreshing. And I think the film does a good job of, like, establishing, like, the camaraderie of, like, being a kid in the 70s. While also just like, oh yeah, kids are just beating the shit out of each other in the park, and then they go to school.
A lot of kid violence in both of these movies.
Some of it, like, to a flinching degree where I'm like, okay, we can ease up. Like, I get it. Like, thanks. Which I think the movie's really effective, but also I'm like, yeah, you could maybe rein it in a tiny bit. But without further ado, let's jump into Black Phone 2, which comes 3 years after that original, again, directed by Scott Derrickson. We have a new setting, somewhat of a new protagonist where we do follow. I feel like more of this film is set on the shoulders of Madeline McGraw's character, Finn's sister in the movie. But Finn has been kind of struggling with his life after this captivity and being a victim of the grabber, but surviving that attempt. But he still is receiving these calls through the black phone. Any payphone he walks by, he's still hearing the ringing. He's still seeing these disturbing visions, or at least his sister is. Of what happened at this different location, completely different from the first movie, this Alpine Lake summer camp. This, like, I think it was a Christian summer camp that they set up. And we kind of switch from Finn more to Madeline McGraw's character, and we follow her kind of issues of what she's encountering with the grabber and his new or his once famed beginnings at this camp, and we get a little bit more of that backstory. So a lot of backstory I wasn't necessarily anticipating in a sequel, but I did really overall enjoy. Corey, what was your big takeaways from Black Phone 2, or how did you feel about it in comparison to the first one?
Yeah, I like the first one more. Going to get into spoilers, at least for the end of the first movie. So if you haven't seen that, kind of hard to talk about this one without getting into that. So we're going to do some spoiler talk. Obviously, the grabber dies at the end of the first one. And it seemed, you know, to me it always seemed like that's a tightly wrapped movie. You don't really need much more. Yeah, exactly. And obviously it did fairly well and had a good following, so they wanted to make a sequel. And I think this one is good. I think it's a fine follow-up. I do like the new location. Again, it's kind of like this cozy atmosphere at, like, this camp during the winter. There's a blizzard, so, like, a small group of characters is in there. I think Madeline McGraw's character, I liked her in the first movie, and the fact that we kind of flip a little bit and get her as the main focus with her dream sequences, and especially how the dream sequences were filmed, where it would be, like, just normal film, and then they would switch to the 8mm, and it would kind of go back and forth as to, like, which perspective we were in. So I like that. It was a nice little creative choice. But I also like dealing with Mason Thames' character and how that first movie affected him. Like, he's just kind of still dealing with that, obviously. He was, like, trapped in a fucking dungeon, and some guys, you know, just keep him down there. So, I like that we still got good stuff with his character and their relationship, too. I really like the brother and sister kind of looking out for each other. This one, for me, I think it got a little bit, I don't know, it did a lot of the sequel thing where it gets a little bit bigger in terms of, like, all right, we're going to have more characters involved here. Like, Damien Bashir is at this camp, and then there's two other people that are there and kind of stuck up. And then there's, like, this boyfriend character who has a crush on Madeline McGraw. He's kind of there for some reason. Not really clear why he went on this trip with them, whatever. But then it also does a lot of diving into the lore of the Grabber at this camp, and then relating that to the history of, like, the two kids and their family. I didn't quite need all that. I liked just having the Grabber be this kind of weird figure that you didn't know anything about. Like, you don't need to know why he's doing this. You don't need to have it connect to things in the past, necessarily, for me. But I did still have a fun enough time with it. I think it is a step down from the first, but a decent horror movie. And again, just in October kind of helps with the season.
Yeah. I think initially after watching this movie, I still think I prefer the second one to the first. I do like what they do with the premise and how they kind of, the Grabber's dead, but how can we further develop that? And yeah, I think a lot of like the big complaints or a lot of the reviews before I saw this movie were equating this to Nightmare on Elm Street and equating this to like, well, this is a good movie, but it also just kind of pulls from a lot of different horror franchises within like the horror genre. And it's just, it feels like a conglomerate of like every other horror franchise. I'm like, I kind of get it. Like, yeah, we got the camp, kind of like Friday the 13th, secluded wilderness, secluded winter wilderness. You got kind of got the thing going. And you got dreams being the main kind of communication aspect that the Grabber can utilize. And you kind of get that with.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Ah, yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy Krueger. So this is kind of pulling from a lot of different franchises, and it does dive into the killer. I feel like a lot of times in franchises, it's like, no, don't tell us about him because then he's not scary. Like, just let him be a random horrible person. Which, I still kind of feel that, even though I do like this film. I'm like, we could have just left it at he's the Grabber and he did bad things, and somehow he has tracked or traced these kids, Finn and Gwen, to this Alpine Lake and is still kind of lingering over them. I agree with you. There are some characters at this camp where I'm like, I think we could ditch a couple of them. Like, I don't need that, like, more of that stuck-up, almost prudish, religious couple, and I don't know. Like, I think we have Mando and his daughter Mustang, and those are like the two overseers of this camp while we're going through this blizzard. I think you leave it at that. I don't know if you need that like quasi boyfriend character. I didn't mind him in the movie, but I'm like, you could probably trim down on some things. I did like the gore. I like the violence. I think that there is some good moments of tension. I will say this is a negative that I don't really throw at this movie, though. It's more of just Scott Derrickson in a hole. I'm done with you doing 8mm. I'm done with you doing Ghost Kids. Between Sinister, Black Phone, and Black Phone 2, fucking move off of it a little bit. It's fine. I like it, and it's effective in all of the movies that I just listed. But I'm more just like, show me a different bag of tricks. I'm getting tired of it. That, and while I don't think this is necessarily as tight of a movie as that first one, I like the change of scenery. I like the setting. I like what they do with the dreams. Sometimes it does get a little bit outlandish, though, where I'm like, okay, well, where's the line to be drawn? Like, where? How does this work? Like, you don't need to explain everything, but I'm like, so can he just go after everyone? Even though he's dead? Like, where? Who is he? Who does he have a direct link to? Because there are moments where I'm like, well, then if you can kill these people, why is he just waiting to kill Gwen or waiting to kill Finn? Yep. Like, you could go after just about anyone at this camp. So there's some kind of like things that I'm torn on or things that didn't 100% work for me. Overall, I did really appreciate Madeline McGraw's performance. Ethan Hawke, I wish we had more of him. I think he does get a little bit sidelined in this, but overall, I had a great time in the theaters with this movie. There is some good gore effects. You don't get it in this movie. I think it was mostly in the first movie. I should have mentioned this earlier, but I love the fact, this little detail of the fact that he changes the fucking bottom part of his mask. Mm-hmm. You get that in the first movie when he comes down with a fucking frown on, and I'm like, what are we doing? What is this? Yeah. Which is almost more terrifying. You don't get that here, but I like the gore that we got with it, and I love how demented Ethan Hawke is in both of these movies. So it's not a like a smash out of the park. It's like a solid double, maybe steal the third. Like I had a good time. Like I really did enjoy this movie, and there are negatives I had, but like I'm willing to not dive too much into them because I'm like, you know what, you like it, leave it at that. Don't try to overthink it too much. And we'll have a good time. And also, it coming out in October is probably also playing into its benefit because this is the type of movie I want to be seeing in October. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think for me, I love Ethan Hawke in both movies. I feel like you got to see more of his weird, quirky personality in the first one.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Whereas this one, he is kind of more that Freddy Krueger, demon almost, yeah. Or he's out on ice skates just killing people. And the kind of what you mentioned of the rules of this movie get a little murky, where you're like, I don't quite understand if it kind of starts out where he's like, he can only impact Gwen in her dreams. I'm like, okay, cool, that's what we've established here, I can go along with it. But then we get to the third act out on the ice and everyone's cutting holes and then he's just whipping people out and they're underwater, and I'm like, I don't, you're kind of breaking your own rules, it feels like, a little bit. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm trying to remember. So in that sequence on the ice, which, again, this is kind of spoilery. It is kind of the climactic thing that you get the shot of it in the trailers of him ice skating, which is really, really good imagery. Why does she go to sleep? Does she go to sleep because bad things start happening with him? Is he there first enacting things? Or does she go to sleep and then he starts enacting things? Do you remember?
I think she starts nodding off in the car or the thing.
And then that allows him, because I'm like, are you able to, whenever Gwen's asleep, you can come out and then you can latch onto people through that? Again, this is us digging into it more than the movie really allows you to really explore it within the film. Mm-hmm. But it's just I'm trying to re-remember. I'm like, so did you guys give me any sort of indication as to why he hasn't been doing this the entire time? I don't know.
Yeah. And that's kind of part of the problem for me, is just the first one was kind of this really tight supernatural thriller where you got the rules of, all right, he can talk to these kids on the phone. They can't do anything, but he can hear their advice, hear what they went through.
Yeah.
This one, it kind of does go a little bit bigger. How far can we go with it? So it's not a huge issue, but it's still, for me, I was just kind of I don't know about this.
This is not needed.
But cool note too, with the original, black phone, it's based on a short story from Joe Hill, who is Stephen King's son. So it's kind of cool. I think he had some ideas for Black Phone 2 that were kind of used. I don't know that it was based on anything really, but I think a solid movie. I don't know that I'll. These aren't two that I'll rewatch all the time. Mm-hmm. The first one I think I'd kind of go back to more. I just kind of the simplicity, like I mentioned, of that first one, mm-hmm. but. Still good. A great kind of horror icon, I think, in The Grabber. We haven't had a lot of those lately. It feels like it's the old slashers of the 90s that we're kind of still going with.
Rebooting Candyman again, stuff like that. It's I like that we have a new, this is a new iteration of what a modern day slasher, even though it's set in the 70s, could be.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to do because the movie's making money. If they were to do a Black Phone 3, would you be excited? If you heard that initial news, how would you react?
Probably how I felt with the second one, where I'm like, how are we going to... not I was going to say...
How are we going to keep it going? How?
Not that this movie necessarily retcons anything from the first movie, because I think that supernatural element was present. So it makes sense how this one could keep going. But I don't know. I would still just prefer this to be one movie, just the first one. But if they had a good idea for it, I'd be down. But like you said, I kind of want Scott Derrickson to move away from this and
start a new horror franchise.
Yeah, or do, if you don't want to do horror, do something else.
Do Doctor Strange again.
Yeah.
Because I love Doctor Strange.
Yeah, do whatever you want to do. But, two good movies, though, I would say, for watching this season. One that I actually just saw this morning, so I'm still kind of processing the movie, is After the Hunt, which is Luca Guadagnino's newest movie. He obviously did Call Me By Your Name, Challengers last year, which you fucking hate.
I can't stand that movie. it sucks because like the score in that, I think that's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross that did it. I love the score, but I can't fucking sit through that movie again in my life.
I think it's okay. It's fine. Some kind of like Luke was fine for me. I think he's okay. But After the Hunt was kind of getting some awards buzz. People are tossing around a lot of acting nominations, possibly. Essentially, it's about a college professor played by Julia Roberts who finds herself at a crossroads when one of her great colleagues, her friends, Andrew Garfield, who's another professor at the school, and then one of her students, played by Iowa Debrie, she levels an accusation against Andrew Garfield, and it kind of, you know, pitting Julia Roberts against the two of them, who she's going to side with. I think the movie is good. I think it's going to be a theme of this week of me saying, this is fine, this is good. I don't think it's quite as good as all the awards chatter I've heard about it, which that happens from time to time. Yeah. I think, first of all, the performances are great. This is probably Julia Roberts' best performance since Aaron Brockovich. She hasn't been in a lot of movies lately, so it's great to see her back. Andrew Garfield is fucking amazing in this movie. I was telling you before about a diner scene with him and Julia Roberts. You kind of see it in the trailer a little bit, but there's like mirrors everywhere, so you get all these different angles, and it's essentially him explaining to Julia Roberts his side of the story, and it's like equal parts terrifying, but you also are kind of siding with him, but it's a really good performance. And any scene that the two of them have together, they have a really deep history. They're very close. As friends, maybe more than friends, which also upsets Michael Stuhlbarg, who is Julia Roberts' husband. And like after a party one time, he's like, he's pretty, still pretty touchy with you, huh? Like he's still there. Yeah. And Michael Stuhlbarg is also really good in this movie.
He's an unsung hero in every movie he's in because he's so fucking good. And him in Call Me By Your Name as being Timothée Chalamet's dad and just like that one of that. More like later moments. I think it's in like the final like 20 minutes of that scene between him and Timothée Chalamet where he's just like, yeah, you're gonna get your heart broken. It's just a good heart to heart in that movie.
He's really good. And he's kind of like the outcast in this movie where everybody else is doing something more interesting than him. Like all the conversations they're having. And there's one point where he's sitting at dinner with Iowa Debrie and Julia Roberts as they're like wanting to have this deep discussion, and he makes some food and he's sitting there like trying to ask questions. Then at a certain point, he's just like, all right, I'm going to leave so you guys can have more interesting conversations, I guess. And then he walks out, starts blaring music. And then they're in the midst of this, like, big discussion. And he keeps swinging the door open, comes, grabs his food, just walks out. And he's just waving his hand, comes back in for his drink, comes back in after his food is done, launches his plate in the sink. As the music is still blaring. So he's just like, all right, nobody fucking wants me here.
He's like, all right,
I'm going to do my own thing. So he's really good. So again, the performance is all great in this movie. I think the first...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
This act of this movie really worked for me. I like the initial setup. I like that kind of that fork in the road of who you're going to side with, that dilemma that Julia Roberts is going through. I think the movie just gets a little stuck in that in the second and third acts. And it's like nearly 2.5 hours long.
I was going to ask how long the fucking thing
is. I started to feel the length in especially the middle act. Because it just kind of kept spinning its wheels a bit. And I'm like, all right, where are we going? And I do like where it ends up. I like moments in the final few scenes. It just took a long time to get there. There's also just a lot of like philosophical conversations between these professors and these scholarly discussions, and that doesn't always, like, hit for me. That's not quite my wavelength.
Of being, like, the most interesting thing to sit through, too.
Yeah, like, I don't love, like, diving into the meaning of everything and how, like, how does this impact this, and it's not quite what I, you know, latch on to. But I think that plays into the movie thinking it's smarter or better than it is, and kind of having that, I don't know, just that air to it where it's like, I don't know if you're saying all that much, even though you think you are.
Yeah.
I think it's good. I think, I mean, if Julia Roberts and Andrew Garfield were to get nominated, I'd be very happy. I just don't think the script always lives up to their great performances. But I didn't have a bad time watching this movie. I think the story is interesting. I like that dilemma for this character. You learn more about Julia Roberts' past, too. So there's some layers to it, but it didn't 100% work for me. But I know a lot of people love it. One of my coworkers saw it, and she's like, I love this movie. I think it's great. But then there were two people in my theater. There's probably like five other people with me. Two ladies walked out halfway through. So I think it's going to be a very polarizing one. And
that feels very much like the Luca Guadagnino
way,
though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, every one of his movies, I feel like I'm seeing people that fucking avidly love his work, and people that are like, what the fuck is... Like, me with Challengers. But I love Suspiria. And I love Catch Me By Your Name... Or Catch Me. Call Me By Your Name. And Queer is such a wild movie. I'm really excited for you to watch that one. Because I love, like, a third, maybe a quarter. I think I love a third of it. Another third of it I really like. And then the last third, I'm like, whoa, what are we doing here? But he's... While I don't love all the stuff that he does, I'm always interested in it. And this is the one where I'm like, I'm pumping the brakes a little bit just because the Challengers pissed me off enough to where I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Even though Queer, I think, sequentially came out later than Challengers from what I remember. But I'll see this eventually. But every one of his movies, I feel like, is slightly polarizing to... I'll see people being like, this is the best movie of the decade. This is the worst piece of trash I've ever seen. You with Challengers. So I'm kind of intrigued to see it. I love the cast. The runtime paired with what I know of Luca Guadagnino is kind of the biggest hurdle for me. I'm like, he doesn't do the most with the runtime he's given, I feel like. He likes to just elongate things in terms of the pacing. I need to check out Bones and All still. That's probably the one that of his filmography I'm more excited to check out. So maybe I'll do that and then bounce back to After the Hunt. After the Hunt isn't going to be one that I'm like pressing to go see unless Oscar noms are in the conversation for like Julia Roberts or Garfield or Iowa Debris. But I'm happy you saw it. Have you seen a lot of his work in theaters?
The only other one I'd seen was Challengers in theaters. I do like Call Me By Your Name a lot, so... Yeah, I don't know. Kind of a mixed bag for me. I, just as a prediction, if you do end up watching it, I think...
Do you think I'll hate it?
I think you're going to be on one of the spectra. I think you're going to either love it or you're going to hate it.
Okay.
That's just a hunch that I have, knowing how you relate to, like, Luca Guadagnino's movies. I think I could picture it both ways where you're like, I actually really like that.
I want you to watch Queer, because I think you might... Similar to me, I think you might really like a portion of it, but then you might fucking hate the rest of it, and the part that I think you're going to hate is the latter portion of it, so I'm like, you might end up leaving that theater absolutely just pissed off. Because there's parts of that movie towards the end where I was like, what are we doing here?
It's crazy that they named a movie after you, though.
Oh, so nice.
That's pretty cool.
I was waiting for it with Black Phone with the grabber of, like, when you brought up Dungeon, I was like, he's going to spin this on me somehow.
I did that last week.
I know, but I was like, I'm not going to put it past him. Like, fine. Queer is a great movie, to a degree. And then it keeps going. So,
fair enough.
Check it out.
Right.
I just because I kind of like Joker Folia do, where I need to watch that so you and I can talk about it. I need you to watch Queer so you and I can talk about that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what we do for next week.
Yeah.
Moving into what I caught up on from this past week. I had a busy weekend, so I had to see a lot of movies throughout the week, which was pretty hard. But a movie that's kind of been on my radar is the comedy Good Fortune, coming from written and directed by Aziz Ansari. A movie that I think they did at CinemaCon, they did a little preview of, and I heard pretty decent buzz around it. Also, it has a pretty great cast with Seth Rogen, Aziz Ansari, Keanu Reeves, Kiki Palmer, and it's a well-meaning but rather inept angel named Gabriel, which Keanu Reeves playing an angel named Gabriel who only saves people from texting and driving. That alone, that logline, perfect. But Gabriel meddles in the lives of a struggling gig worker and a wealthy venture capitalist. The venture capitalist, played by Seth Rogen, the gig worker, played by Aziz Ansari. And it's just a whole kind of like the grass is greener on the other side. And we get to see these different perspectives from these worker, like a worker that's really struggling to make ends meet. And he's like, you know what? Fuck it. My life's not worth living. And then luckily Gabriel intervenes and he's like, well, I'll give you a chance at life. I'll let you live in the shoes of this really wealthy man. And then he's like, I fucking love this. Solved all my problems. I don't want to go back. And then you get like kind of that big dilemma of like, well, how do we learn from this and how do we fix this? I think the trailers market a movie that looks really engaging and entertaining and funny. I still think the movie is entertaining. The movie's not funny. I think I laughed once in the full hour 40-minute runtime, roughly around there. I think hour 39 or something. This movie is, I think, really well directed, but I didn't find myself laughing a lot. But I did still enjoy watching the movie. I liked these characters. It takes a while to really get to what the main conflict is of, all right, well, we have these trio of characters. We have Gabriel, we have Aziz Ansari, who's this gig worker that's now living this mogul's life, and we have the mogul that's now living the gig worker's life. Okay, now what are we going to do that's interesting? Well, the most interesting thing is it's Seth Rogen, Keanu Reeves, and Aziz Ansari, so we get that hilarious chemistry and camaraderie that falls between them, and we don't get enough of it. But when we get it, it's fantastic. So I'm like, this movie feels like it was a little muddled at times. We also, like I mentioned, Kiki Palmer's in this movie, and she's kind of sidelined to a degree and has her own kind of subplot going, and her subplot isn't as interesting as this trio of characters. But Keanu Reeves steals the show in just about every scene that he's in as Gabriel. He does this thing. He oversteps his boundaries as this angel. He gets his wings redacted, taken away from him, and now he has to live as a human. And he's just smoking darts and working at like a China buffet.
Hell yeah.
And he's washing dishes and he just has no love of life. And I'm like, I like some of the things that this story has, but I don't love the whole of it. Overall, I did have like a good enough time in theaters. It just was, like I said, it wasn't as funny as I was hoping it would be. But overall, I enjoyed the performances. I enjoyed the characters to a degree. And I think that it's a good comedic attempt at something we've kind of already seen before, almost like that It's a Wonderful Life of, I hate my life. And he's like, well, let me show you actually why your life is not that bad. And I think that this is a good kind of modern retelling of that dilemma, that trope. So I would recommend it. It's just, leave your expectations at the door. It's not the funniest thing. But also, maybe if you're a big Aziz Ansari fan, you might really like the humor here. He hasn't worked for me since I was like in middle school, so I've aged past that humor, I think. But if you like him, you might find this movie to be really funny. I didn't find myself laughing all too often.
Yeah, I've heard from a couple of people that have seen it that it's enjoyable, it's fun, a good enough time, but nothing that, you know, like you're saying, is you have to rush out and see right now. So I'll definitely watch it eventually. But a movie that I watched this week, which I was very excited about, another one in limited release, is Ballad of a Small Player, which is limited like right now, which I said, but then it's coming out on Netflix on October 29th. This is the newest movie from Edward Berger, who has just cranked out a couple great movies in the past couple of years with All Quiet on the Western Front and Conclave, two very different movies, but two that I really like. And I really like this one, too. This is my favorite movie I watched this week. And it's kind of, for some weird reason, it's gotten like middling reviews or kind of, again, kind of polarizing in a weird way. But Colin Farrell plays this gambler in Macau who is just the extremes of the highs of gambling and the low of gambling is really explored in this movie, where he just went in everything. And you're like, all right, get out. Just take what you got, get out. And he's like, no, I can get more. And it's, everybody, you know, everybody that has gambled knows that, obviously, where you're like, what if I just put 20 more in here? What if I did that? And it really does kind of dive into that theme in this movie of there's like this festival that they have in Macau. I would believe it's a real thing. I don't know 100%, but there's a character that's talking with Colin Farrell in the movie about this festival of the Realm of Hungry Souls, it's called. And essentially she's talking to him about how, you know, people...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Like, they keep consuming and consuming and eating and eating and eating, but they're never satisfied. And obviously plays into the theme of gambling, where you just you keep winning, 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 you're never satisfied, and then it tanks. So it's really a exploration into the descent of just madness of this gambler played by Colin Farrell. And he has a great scene, too, where he's just like, I want to try and get rid of all the shame that I have in my body, and I feel like this is the way to do it. And it's really just a very, like... I don't know if fun movie is the right word, but it's a fun journey with this character where you have Colin Farrell giving a great performance. He's so committed. He has these yellow gloves that he wears. And
this, I noticed that. I was making the thumbnail for this video, and I didn't see this movie, and I was like, what the fuck are these gloves about?
That's part of the great sound design of this movie, because, like, anytime he has cards, it's just, like, the rubbery gloves and the cards, and, like, it really, the sound is great. There's, like, a section where they're on like this creaky boat, and just like the wood and the water, it sounds really great. The cinematography in this movie is beautiful. I would love to see that get nominated this year. And then the Volker Bertelmann score, we've mentioned him a couple times. House of Dynamite, All Quiet on the Western Front won an Oscar for, and yeah, the memorable score. But his is really it propels this movie along. It's kind of a little bit different than those other two. And there's also a couple moments in this movie that are, like, two of the scarier moments I've seen in a movie this year, which I didn't expect from this, where it's like a reflection that Colin Farrell has seen, and it just comes out of nowhere, but it's terrifying and kind of plays into that realm of hungry souls like I mentioned. So, really cool movie. I really dug watching this. Edward Berger, I think... with just these last few movies, has shown his range of not sticking with one genre, really. The only little flaws I would say is that there is, I don't know, like, plot twist isn't the right phrase for it, but there's a revelation made in the movie that I saw coming pretty early on, and I'm normally not good with those type of things. I'm normally like, whoa, what the fuck? Oh, that's the killer? Or whatever
it is. I can confirm this.
Yeah. Oh, wow, I didn't see that. And everyone's like, no, we knew that from the first 20 minutes. I'm like, okay, don't need to be mean. But this one I actually caught on too quick. And, like, I think that speaks to, like, I don't think it was hidden all that well, if that's what they were intending. But they kind of treat it as a plot twist almost, and they sort of do a little bit to over-explain it, which I didn't need. I liked the revelation itself. I just think that they do a bit too much of trying to spoon-feed you what's happening at the end. Other than that, I really liked it. I know this is based on a book as well. I haven't read it, but would be very curious to read it now just because I really like the story. Performance is great. I like the theme of diving into the just madness of a gambler and the highs and lows and all of that. So, I dug this movie. This is probably in my top 10 for the year.
Damn.
I really dug it. And again, it's getting kind of mixed reviews, but I just think Edward Berger is such a fascinating director to watch. And it's like easily becoming one of my favorites of just looking forward to his next project.
Yeah. I remember I didn't see Ballad of a Small Player. It was on my list this past week. I was going to try to do it, but I couldn't make it work logistically. I remember when they were still trying to figure out who was going to direct the next Bond film, Denis Villeneuve got announced, and he's my favorite director working today. But I was gunning for Edward Berger. I wish mm-hmm. Edward Berger was the next director for a James Bond film, because I think he could do something really interesting and really cool. And I've loved All Quiet on the Western Front and Conclave, and I'm sure I'm really going to get something out of this, whether I love it or not, because I have seen polarizing reviews. I do tend to side with Corey, though, and our opinions tend to find or fall along the same side of this of the spectrum. So I think I will have a good time with this. What I have seen from this movie in terms of like the trailers, I love the style of it. The yep. coloring of it looks great.
Yep.
I think it's visually going to be something I'm really excited to see. I just need to go see it. I don't know the logistics of if it's showing around us still, but I want to try and catch it in theaters before it drops on Netflix on October 29th. So wish me luck. If I'm lucky in that affair and I'm able to see this, hopefully I'll be able to talk about it by next week's episode. A movie that I got to catch up on, again, another Netflix original with air quotes, because this was a movie acquired by Netflix after a good kind of festival run. A movie that Corey talked about last week, which is The House of Dynamite, directed by the great Catherine Bigelow, who did The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, Point Break. This is a star-studded cast in a paranoid political thriller of the world about to basically end. We're on the verge of chemical warfare, nukes going off everywhere. Corey brought it up, talked about it last week, so I don't want to like harp too much on this movie, but I fucking loved this movie. And this is very much like a talking thriller. Like, there, you don't see a lot of the threat. You just hear about it. And you see the people reacting to it. People that have to do their job, but also their husband's calling them, or their daughter's calling them, or they need to reach out to someone and kind of give them the nudge to, hey, get the fuck out. You need to run. It's going to get bad. And you can feel the tension of that through every minute of this movie. I love this movie. Like I said, it's a star-studded cast. You have Idris Elba being the President of the United States, which, fuck, I'd elect him as the President of the United States, especially after this movie. I liked what they did with his character. There was a moment in the movie while watching it that I was like, I don't know if I needed this. The Angel Reese part. I don't, like, it's not even just Angel Reese. It's more of like, I don't know what this does to service the plot. But thinking back on, like, real-world history, it makes me think of, like, the George Bush reading to children, and then someone comes and tells him in the ear, like, what's going on at the World Trade Center. So that's how it kind of read for me, and after I got that kind of perspective on it, I was like, I love this now. I can see people having issues with the structure, which you brought up last week. I would get if you have issues with the structure. There's points where I'm like, it doesn't 100% work. But overall, I think getting three distinct perspectives of overlapping kind of time frames and how we can see it from this point of view versus this, and how that kind of builds tension and also emotionally gets us further like enthralled and really caring about these characters. Jared Harris is the fucking MVP of this movie. And there is a couple of scenes throughout this movie that genuinely had me shocked. And a scene specifically that me and Corey talked about off camera that I'm not going to say now, because you should see this movie and experience it for yourself, when a character just keeps on walking. And God, does that hurt. I really loved this movie. It was expertly paced. It has a ending that I think fully fits this movie. So I would definitely implore you to go check this out. Try and find it in a theater near you if it's still showing in theaters. It is coming to Netflix later on this week. So I don't know what the logistics of it being in theaters still is. But House of Dynamite is a great film from Catherine Bigelow. I don't know what specifically, but I hope that this gets nominated for something at the Oscars, because I want this to remain in the conversation for a long time, because it was a thriller that had me genuinely scared. And I don't get those a lot. So I fucking love this movie. It was a blast. I don't know where it is in my top 10, but it's around there. I don't know if I ranked it even yet. So I need to look at that further, but it is one of the better movies I've seen in 2025.
Yeah, I'm glad you got to see it. And with both of these past two movies we talked about, Ballad of a Small Player, House of Dynamite, anytime there's a Netflix movie in theaters, go see it to show them that we want a full theatrical release.
Because, for these movies, yeah.
Like, with both of these, especially the sound is incredible.
The score for House of Dynamite, which we just talked about, the same composer for Ballad of a Small Player, but so good. I've been listening to All Quiet on the Western Front and the score for House of Dynamite a lot this past week. It's so good.
Yeah. So the sound, the visuals of both of those movies are great. They should be seen in a theater. So definitely go support those. One that I caught up on this week was Roofman, which stars Channing Tatum, who is playing a real life guy who was a criminal who got infamous or got famous for breaking into places through the roof, but then he was really nice to the people that he broke in, and he's just like, "Hey, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm just going to steal some money. I'm going to put you guys like in a McDonald's. I'm going to put you guys in a freezer. Make sure you have your coats.
Yeah.
It's going to be cold in there. Put those on." And like everybody, there's even real life interviews at the end of this movie where people talked about like, yeah, he was stealing, but like he was really kind to us, and like he just wasn't mean at all. He was just like, I just need this. You aren't the problem here. I'm not going to like, this isn't an armed robbery. Yeah. So just kind of a very interesting story. And Channing Tatum plays it really well as just this very charismatic character. He has really great chemistry with Kirsten Dunst in this movie, who he kind of starts a relationship with. She's kind of a single mom who has two kids. She's working at a Toys R Us, and that happens to be the place that Channing Tatum is staying at. He just finds this like middle area of the store where nobody can get to and just makes a little bed with Spider-Man sheets and puts posters up on the wall and has M&Ms. And then Peter Dinklage... Peter Dinklage is the manager of the store, and he's like, we're a little low on peanut M&Ms in the inventory. And everyone's like, I don't know. And he's just like calling out this fat guy, like, you're stealing peanut M&Ms.
What's in the tummy?
Come on, yeah.
What's in the tummy?
So, just a fun idea, and like every kid's dream of being locked in a Toys R Us overnight, yeah. Like that sort of idea. But it's really fun because you get to see like this character and Channing Tatum playing this character of like being very observant. Like, he is very smart and knowing how to like kind of bypass the security cameras recording and how to like stop the exit door so he can get out without the alarm going off. All these little things that he's figuring out is fun.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's just a very entertaining movie, and just it's kind of a... I wish it would have been released in December, because it has like holiday stuff of like a little Halloween, little Thanksgiving, but kind of a lot of Christmas towards the end.
Toy drive type stuff.
Yep, and it would have felt like more of like a good Christmas season movie, I think. I think it's a little bit too long, where like a movie like this, the kind of nature of this type of story where you have a character that's withholding a secret from somebody, like Channing Tatum with Kirsten Dunst. She doesn't know that he's this criminal that's on the run, which, again, that's another part where it's like, nobody knows his face around here. Like, he kind of moves a couple towns over after the initial thing where he breaks out of prison, but it's like, it's kind of all over the news, like somebody would know. Yeah. But, you know, just kind of with the nature of it where it's like, you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. You're like, okay, everything's good now, but like, you're just waiting for this scene for them to figure out and yeah. be like, so, and that happens with a lot of movies and shows. That's a big thing, obviously, in like, you know, 20-minute episodes of a show or something. But yeah, just a lot of fun. I had a good time with it. Channing Tatum's very charismatic. There's a scene where he is just in a Red Lobster on like this singles date with a bunch of women from a church, and he's just like gossiping with them and talking about their shoes. And just like, it's Channing Tatum at his just all-time kind of best there. So I had a good time with it. I would recommend it, you know, even if you don't see it in theaters, just for the holiday season. I think it's a good family watch too, just kind of a crowd-pleasing movie. So yeah, a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's one I've had on the radar for the past couple of weeks, but it hasn't like, I've heard good things, so I haven't just been ushered into the theater quite yet to go see it. I'm going to try and catch it sooner or later, so whether that's on streaming. I'm hoping to get it in theaters, but it might end up being on streaming just since we're kind of now entering that time period where I feel like every week we have like one to two releases where I'm like, I need to see that. So I'm still really excited about this just because I really like the director's previous works, Blue Valentine and Place Beyond the Pines. And also, it's interesting to look at like Channing Tatum's career as a whole, and it's like, wasn't he in like the Step Up dance movies basically? Yep. And then he was in Magic Mike, and it's like, oh no, he can act and he's funny in the 21 Jump Street movies, and now we had Foxcatcher, and everyone's like, oh shit, he can like act.
Yeah.
So it's cool seeing him. Like I'm always been a big Channing Tatum fan, so I'm interested to see a movie where it's just like kind of a more of a straight up drama where he's just the leading man. So and the trailers have really worked for me, so I'm excited to check it out when I do. A couple of movies that I caught up on and rewatched for it being October, Halloween, spooky season, whatnot, were Hocus Pocus, directed by Kenny Ortega, who I did not know until I started doing show notes, was also the director of High School Musical, upon other things, or among other things, but also directed High School Musical. A film starring Bette Midler, Sarah Jessica Parker, Kathy Najimy, and Omri Katz. I've seen this movie a number of times. I feel like played on Disney Channel, ABC Family, always around this time of the year. So this was a movie that my wife was like, we need to watch this. We're getting into that time. It's crunch time. We need to watch our favorite Halloween movies. And it's a movie that I think is still equally as charming and as effective as it was when it came out in 93. I think it works for me to the nth degree. I still haven't seen the sequel to it. Maybe I'll check that out this month. But I love Hocus Pocus. Just wanted to make a mention that I watched that. And if you haven't seen Hocus Pocus, it holds up remarkably well, aside from some shoddy CGI cat effects that I'm like, oh, okay, that's very Disney Channel original movie. But this movie is a great time, and it's a staple of the Halloween season for a good reason. I also watched Addams Family Values, which is the sequel to Addams Family. This one came out also in 1993, similar to Hocus Pocus. Directed by Barry Sonnenfeld. I wanted to make a mention or make notice that this man directed a lot of good movies. Men in Black 1, 2, 3. Also directed RV, which is a nostalgic movie from my childhood that I watched a lot with Robin Williams. He also did Nine Lives with Kevin Spacey. We'll leave it there. But this film stars the gangbusters cast of the Addams Family crew from the 90s, which was Angelica Houston, Raul Julia, Christiana...
Yeah, but
I'm adding too
you're
many.
You're gonna get there,
to Christina.
There you go,
Christina Ricci. The all-time fucking MVP of this movie is Joan Cusack. We also got Christopher Lloyd, but this is the Addams Family trying to rescue Uncle Fester from this new gold-digging wife that he has stumbled into having, who is also maybe a murderer, played by Joan Cusack, and she is one. Okay, this is gonna sound mean. I've never been like. I always thought Joan Cusack was a pretty person, but I've never been attracted to her. Then I saw this movie and I was like, oh my god. So she's so sexy in this movie, very attractive, and I get why Fester is just ogling and boggling over this woman. But also she has such good timing that fits within this established cast, and she runs the gambit for this entire sequel. So Addams Family Values, I remember it mostly from that one John Mulaney joke where he called a blockbuster and he was like, you guys have Addams Family Values yet? And just that was the thing that sticks in my mind. But this is actually a really good sequel to that first movie. I like that first movie a lot. And I think quality-wise, they're like neck and neck. So if you haven't seen Addams Family Values, definitely check it out. It's worth it.
I have not seen any of the Addams Family movies or any Wednesday, any of that stuff. So someday I'll probably try and catch up on the movies. Yeah, I'm going to try and watch.
Check the movies out. I didn't see the animated Addams Family. I've seen both seasons of Wednesday and the season 3 that is inevitably coming. I will watch too, but I'm not excited about any of that. So stick to the movies. You'll probably have a good time.
Yeah. As far as Hocus Pocus, I watched that kind of late in life. It was probably like 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it. I watched it in October just to kind of catch up on it. But I don't have that nostalgia for it. Yeah. But
I just had a massive crush on Sarah Jessica Parker.
Oh, yeah.
This movie, specifically.
Yeah, I can understand why a lot of people have that nostalgia and love the movie, even if like it's not for, you know, I don't quite have that. But for me, Halloween watching this week, I continued my Texas Chainsaw Massacre watch through. They actually mentioned that in the first Black Phone. One of the kids is like, dude, we gotta go watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
What was it, that or was it... Was it a Bruce Lee movie? Or was it
something like that, yeah.
Was it Bloodsport? They were talking about martial arts movies.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh no, it's still not as good as Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay.
but this week I watched two of the sequels, which are Leatherface Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 and Texas Chainsaw Massacre The Next Generation. Let's start out with 3. We get Viggo Mortensen in the third one, which I didn't know he was in this movie. But he's a lot of fun. He's playing this kind of southern guy. I mean, all these movies take place in Texas, obviously. But essentially, it kind of goes back to the formula of that first movie. Like last week I mentioned, the second movie kind of goes in weird directions and underground amusement parks and all this weird type of shit. This one is more so just the people driving in a car, and then Leatherface comes at night and they get trapped and they're out in the woods, and has all that fun elements to it. It's less campy than the second movie, I would say. It really does feel like they're just trying to kind of redo the first movie, yeah. Which...
Get back to basics
of it. And it's sort of... these first four movies are weird because they all sort of retcon each other, where they're like, this is the true sequel. This is what we actually wanted to tell. Because, like, at the end of the second movie, I guess, spoiler alert, like, the whole cannibal family, the Texas Chainsaw family, gets blown up by a grenade. Uh-huh. Dennis Hopper just has a grenade and just blows everyone up. They're dead. But then in this one, it's like some of those same family members and people are in it, or, like, their kids are in it.
They all found a way to fuck someone and have an offspring.
Somebody was there, so it's like, I don't know quite how the continuity works. It's not concerned with that, really. It's fun enough. It's fine. As a sequel, I liked it more than the second one, just because it was a little bit more fun, and Viggo Mortensen is pretty crazy and wild in it.
Is he part of the family in it? Who does he play?
He's part of the crazy family. Don't know that for a little bit. He seems like he's helping out this couple and some other people in the movie. But, he ends up being one of the family members, which is fun, and I like seeing him. There is a really funny part in this movie where Leatherface is always just a big, dumb oaf in all of these movies.
You probably can't fucking see anything out of a mask.
No. And probably stinks in there really bad.
For sure.
But he's always kind of like this big, almost like a kid. But he has this, like, kind of alphabet toy where, like, you have to spell something on it. And it shows him a picture of a clown, like a person dressed up as a clown. And you have to type in the word of what it is. And he keeps typing in food. And it just won't work. And he tries it probably 15 times, like, food, click, wrong, food, wrong. And he's just getting so frustrated because it's like, no, this... I eat this thing. It's a human.
That's breakfast, lunch,
and dinner. Then he just whips the thing against the fucking wall because he gets so mad. So there's like, I don't know. I had a fun enough time with this movie. It's not great by any means, but it's okay. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, which is the fourth one. Again, they kind of marketed this as like the true sequel, yeah. What we really wanted to do. What? It's not. It's this one kind of sucks.
Damn it. This has a good cast.
This has an interesting cast. It has Matthew McConaughey, much like Viggo Mortensen. He's very fun and wild and crazy in this movie, which I like to see. Renee Zellweger is one of the kids. It's really like this group of kids after prom. They're driving on a road, and then they encounter the Texas Chainsaw family. Whatever. It's the same in all these fucking movies.
They'll stumble upon them somehow.
Yeah. The characters in this movie are just unbearable.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I really hated them. They're just high school kids that are poorly written, really just poorly acted in almost every regard. But, McConaughey, like I said, is fun. The story is more of the same, but not in a fun way. It's really weird, especially towards the last act of the movie. There's like a weird... there's a weird secret society that they introduce of like... they kind of do another dinner scene, like the first movie, where they're all around, people are tied up. And then this guy in a suit comes into the room, and he's, like, checking in on the family. And you're like, what the fuck is this? And then the end of the movie, like, the main character gets away and gets in a limo with this character, and they kind of explain what's going on, but not really, where they're like, yeah, we're doing this and we're trying to profit off of this cannibal family doing these things, and we have different families around the country or something that are doing cannibal things, and we like to do it because it like opens spiritual things within people when they're... It's a weird fucking ending.
It's like when the Halloween franchise and like the later installments were like, the Cult of Thorn, and then they never acknowledge it. Like after two, they're like, actually, this was a bad idea.
I don't know if this comes up in later movies or any of the remakes or anything. I would assume not, because it's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm working my way through this franchise. A couple of weeks is about all it can take.
How many more do you have? Is there six? Five?
So I have...
Because you have...
I think I have five left.
There's fucking nine of these?
There's nine of them, man. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm about halfway through. I've really liked one of them. The third one's sort of a campy fun time. Two and four I haven't really cared for. So, yeah, this is not quite as fun of a rewatch or like a watch through as some of the other horror franchises. But
what has been your favorite so far?
The original. I mean, that's...
No. Your favorite... Okay, that's good to know. But your favorite horror franchise that you've watched through on a Halloween?
Of the last few years, Halloween, for sure.
Yeah.
That was just fun watching through. Because I actually think a lot of those sequels, even if they're not all good, like, there's good stuff in them.
They hold up pretty well, yeah.
Like, even 4 is okay. I like 2 a lot. Yeah, like, 4 is great. Season of the Witch, I love. I think the movie's great.
That is a movie I'm gonna force upon my wife, because she's like...
What?
Okay, that makes sense. I was hoping you wouldn't pause me. I'm gonna force this movie upon my wife, because she doesn't like the newer Halloween movies, which I get. They're not, like, quality-wise the best, even though I like them. But they're also... The newer ones are really gory. She's only seen the original Halloween and then parts of Halloween 2. Mm. So I'm like, I want to show you Season of the Witch, because that to me is like the quintessential Halloween movie. Even though it's not Michael Myers. And it's completely like void of everything in that franchise. So I'm like, I love Season of the
Witch. Also, H2O is great.
H2O is a great...
I think that's Jamie Lee Curtis's best performance.
H2O and then 2018 are doing the same job, but one of them does it slightly better. And I think it's H2O.
Yeah.
I just have nostalgia. I feel like AMC, the AMC channel, growing up, would always do like a Halloween like marathon leading up through like all of October up to Halloween. So I was always watching them on TV like late at night. And I was like, oh my God, there he is. There's Michael. There's Michael Myers. Oh fuck. And then Donald Pleasance with his like scarred up face. I was like, oh my God, Loomis, get the fuck out. Like,
I know like Quentin Tarantino's like praised H2O. He's like, that's like I kind of said, like, that's Jamie Lee Curtis's best performance as Laurie Strode. Like,
H2O
she's really good.
You can watch that. This is a tangent. I love the Halloween franchise so much because you can watch it in so many different ways. You can watch them sequentially and just get a really wild experience. You can watch Halloween, Halloween 2, and then I think you can watch H2O. I'm trying to remember the
there's like six different continuities.
You can follow different continuities, and you just like, what continuity do you want to watch this October? Mm-hmm. Which for me right now, I want to watch H2O and I want to watch Season of the Witch, which those don't really have anything to fucking do with each other. So I can watch whatever the fuck I want. I'm gonna. my wife wants to watch Halloween, I think, on Halloween night though. That I'm like, yep, I picked the right person to marry. You're smart. So I'm excited to check that out. In terms of, aside from movies and stuff that we watch around the spooky season, I meant to talk about this last week, and I lost it and forgot about it and didn't mention anything about it. I'm a big Mike Flanagan fan. He did a lot of the great Netflix horror series, both Haunting at Hill House, Midnight Mass, The Midnight Club, which is fine. But he also did Haunting of Bly Manor, which is a horror franchise or a horror limited series that I tried to watch with my wife when we were still dating. And I couldn't get through it. I couldn't get into it. It felt stale to me the first time I watched through it, or attempted to watch through it. But we sat down, and I promised her I would watch it because she really loves this limited series. Watched it, episodes, I think one... Oh, I don't even remember. I think it's 9 episodes. Loved it. Works so well. It's not scary, but it is a fantastic ghost story. And I think it handles the idea of ghosts so well, better than... honestly, most properties or franchises I've seen. So I'm not going to dive into it. It has a great cast. If you're a big fan of Mike Flanagan, check it out. I think this is one of his better Netflix outings. I think Midnight Mass is by far and away his best, but I think this and Haunting of Hill House are up there too. He also did The Fall of House of Usher, which was pretty good. But this is a very great, slow burn, almost romantic ghost story. and I was 100% satisfied by it. So I'd recommend it. It's on Netflix. It's easily accessible, and it's a great time to just kind of throw on an episode and watch it one episode per night for a week or so. But looking ahead, we do have a massive release coming out. Well, it's a small release, but to us it's massive because it's coming from a person that we deeply admire, which is YouTuber Chris Duckman, who is finally releasing his film that he directed, Shelby Oaks, which got picked up by Neon and has been able to fully develop. And I'm sure that they've added more money to the budget, reshot, whatever. I'm just excited to see what Stuckman put out there. This is starring Sarah Dunn, Camille Sullivan, Michael Beach, and also I remember the GoFundMe video that he did an update for, where he's like, if you guys, like, not that I'm asking you to give, but if you give more, we can get an A-list or an A-tier character actor in here, which was Keith David, who's also in this film. It's a film about a woman's desperate search for her long-lost sister who falls into obsession upon realizing that the imaginary demon from their childhood may have been real. I can't fucking wait to see this movie. One, because I helped fund this movie. Not that I deserve any credit. I gave him like $80 so I can get a Blu-ray and a poster, which I got the poster this week. And it's like the standard release poster, but I was just like, holy shit, I have a poster from Shelby Oaks. So I'm excited about that. I'm going to hopefully AMC Screen Unseen Horror Thrills and Chills, whatever their fucking mystery movie tonight is. It's roughly this runtime, and it's a rated R horror movie, so I'm hoping it's this so I can go see it tonight. I can't fucking wait for this movie. This is like, I'm going to steal something from my wife because she gave a maid of honor speech at a wedding this past weekend. This is my Super Bowl. This horror movie.
Ugh.
Allie, that was a great line when you said it in the speech, but I'm going to make fun of you here for it. I'm really excited for this movie. This is the movie that, like, of this week, this is the event C for me. What about you, Corey?
Man, this one is cool. Chris Stockman just put out a video today on his YouTube.
I watched that.
Just talking about how appreciative he is of everybody that contributed, like you did, to the GoFundMe, the Kickstarter, everything. And just his push for seeing independent movies in theaters and his hope that this movie can inspire people who have maybe been stuck of making movies to get back into it, to write a script, to do it. And he's like, if somebody came up to me and said, like, your movie inspired me to keep going with mine, like, that'd be the greatest honor. It's so cool. We've been watching him for over a decade now of doing movie reviews. And at least for me, like, when I, you know, a little bit over a decade now, when I started watching movies consistently and, like, really going to the theater a lot, Chris Stuckman was a guy that I just, like, learned so much about how to talk about a movie and how to analyze it, how to review a movie, and, you know, along with other YouTubers for sure, but he was kind of one of the main ones. And the fact that he's put so much into this over the years, if you've watched his channel, just getting the updates on it, it's so cool. I'm so excited for this movie. I hope it's good. You know, I it looks really cool. The trailer looks good. I hope there's some freaky moments in there. So I can't wait for it. It'll be kind of the highlight of talking about stuff next week for sure. The other big thing coming out is Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, which is the Bruce Springsteen movie based on a book. And it's about making his 1982 album, Nebraska. And Jeremy Allen White has looked great in the trailers. The sound, just as Bruce Springsteen, sounds so close to it, which is crazy. You get Jeremy Strong in there, Paul Walter Hauser as well. So it's coming from Scott Cooper, who I think is one of the most underrated directors in Hollywood. I've really liked, I think, all of his movies. I haven't seen Black Mass. That's the only of his that I haven't seen.
You would like it.
Okay.
You would like it.
Yeah. But like Crazy Heart, another music-based movie that I absolutely love. Jeff Bridges and Colin Farrell are so good in that movie. And then, yeah, like Hostiles, Antlers, Pale Blue Eye. Like, those are all such good movies that people talk about for a little bit and then kind of forget. But I think he's a really talented director. Jeremy Allen White is one of the biggest rising stars in Hollywood for sure. And I can't wait to see this movie. I may try and see it with my mom. I know she likes Bruce Springsteen, The Boss. So, yeah, this one looks great. I mean, it sort of feels like a complete unknown from last year, where could get a Best Actor nomination, possibly a few other awards for sure. So I'll definitely be trying to see this one next week. If not, if I have to delay it, For sure the next week.
Yeah, the biggest thing here for me is Scott Cooper, because I'm also, like you, a big fan of his movies. And I the Pale Blue Eye is the movie I still, like, maybe is the, like, piece of homework burning a hole in my pocket. I've needed to watch that movie for so long. And I think it might be ripe for, like, an October watch. So I want to try and capitalize on that and get that checked off my list. I am tired of musical biopics. I mention that every time we talk about one. I do like Springsteen. I like the casting, I like what I've seen, and I like the director, so I am sure I inevitably will end up seeing this movie, and I think it'll likely be an awards conversation, at least I'm hoping for it, just because I really do love Scott Cooper. I don't know if I'm going to be rushing out to see this. Honestly, as long as I see Shelby Oaks this week, I don't need to see a single other movie this week, but this would be the second step for me, because it's definitely not Regretting You, which is also coming out this week, directed by Josh Boone, who's the director of The Fault in Our Stars, which is a great movie. And The New Mutants, which is a movie I've never seen. And I debate on it every time I'm on Disney Plus. I'm like, do I venture into that?
Is that the only X-Men movie you haven't seen?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, it definitely is. And this is starring Allison Williams, McKenna Grace, Dave Franco, Mason Thames, who is kind of popping off a little bit. He has a little bit of a good fall with Black Phone 2 in this. Scott Eastwood, who is Mr. Forgettable, but he is here as well. Willa Fitzgerald and Clancy Brown, who has the best voice in Hollywood. But this film centers on a strained relationship between a young mother and her teenage daughter. And it's been exasperated by the death of a husband, and there's a tragic death, and I don't know. They're all trying to fucking reconvene, and maybe mom likes my uncle because my husband, or because my dad's dead. Like, I don't know. It looks pretty formulaic, rom-com. It looks pretty cheesy, at least from what I've seen from the trailers. It's wild to me. The biggest standout for this is, like, seeing McKenna Grace becoming more of an adult, because, like, in my eyes, she was always going to be a little kid, and now I'm like, holy shit, you're so old now. So, it's nice that we're getting a romantic movie in theaters, just because I don't think we get, like, a lot of, like, straightforward romance movies. Granted, that's also not necessarily the genre I'm rushing to go see, so I'm not, like, terribly excited for this for me, but if this is your kind of forte, then happily, please go support this in theaters. I'm not going to be there. If I hear amazing things out of the woodwork about this movie, maybe I'll check it out. I'm not anticipating that or expecting that, so I will leave this to the fans of this genre to hopefully support, because I want all movies to do well.
I think this is based on a Colleen Hoover book, too. So I think there's probably a lot of fans of that book that are wanting to go see this movie. And I think McKenna Grace and Mason Thames are dating, maybe?
In real life?
I think so, yeah. Which, cool. That's kind of sweet. That makes me happy. But yeah, I don't know too much about the movie or anything. But like you, if I hear good things, I may try and check it out. Also want to point out that we are eating Reese's Cup. Sorry, I say Reese Cup.
Yeah, it makes you sound like a child.
A little Reese cup.
Reese
cup filled with Oreos. I saw these at the store today. While each of us has been talking, we've each been reaching into the bag and trying to unwrap them quietly. And you could probably hear it on the thing.
I keep trying to check the camera angles to see I'm not getting in Corey's shot.
Yeah, these are really good, though. I really like them. It's Oreos in a Reese cup, and then probably Reese's cup, whatever you want to say. They're really solid. There's also, like, Oreos that have Reese in them.
I'm not on.
So, yeah, go for it.
I have six.
They're really solid. Also, there's a marshmallow-filled Butterfinger that I want to try.
Don't give me hope.
Look, I keep seeing the commercials, and it's like Halloween time. You got to try the Butterfinger marshmallow. I'm like, you're so right, I do. So anytime I go get gas the next time, I'm going to...
See, I love candy.
Yeah.
I love chocolate.
Yeah.
I'm a fat kid at heart. If I see ads like that, I will decimate my bank account.
This is why I bought these today, to have for a little mid-podcast snack when neither of us are talking. the last...
Fuck.
Yeah, they're so good. Coors Banquet and Reese Oreo. Oh, great.
The most contradicting flavors.
That's all right, whatever. the other movie that's coming out this week in limited release is called Blue Moon. It's one of two Richard Linklater movies from this year, his other being Nouvelle Vague, coming out in a couple weeks, I think it is. But this is about the story of Lorenz Hart, who is a lyricist, a songwriter, and he has a lot of alcoholism and mental health issues, and I think it takes place kind of in one room as he's trying to save face during the opening of the play Oklahoma. And Ethan Hawke is the lead role here. You got Margaret Qualley, Bobby Cannavale, Andrew Scott in the movie as well. I like Richard Linklater enough. This one looks good. I don't know how wide it's going to be playing around us. We'll see. But I'm more excited for Nouvelle Vague, his other movie. I'm just kind of more interested in the story of that than this one. I don't know too much about Lorenz Hart in real life, or Oklahoma for that matter. But certainly one I'll check out just because of all the names attached to it, for sure.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at, too. I love the Before trilogy. And Last Flag Flying is a good little drama that I feel like is a little bit underappreciated, underseen, with Steve Carell, Bryan Cranston, and Lawrence Fishburne. I would definitely recommend that film. But Richard Linklater kind of consistently hits for me. Everybody Wants Some, one of the best hangout movies there is. I'll check this out. I completely spaced on this movie and didn't even know it was coming out. I've been more aware of his other work coming out this year as opposed to this one. So I'm like, oh shit, I forgot he had two. So I'll check it out as soon as I possibly can. Shelby Oaks is still going to be the main precedent, the first movie I'm rushing to theaters to go see. In terms of a physical media roundup, I thought about buying a couple of movies this week. I ended up buying none. So it's been a slow week for me, but I'm excited to... I have a bunch in my Amazon shopping cart, and I'm like, no, I'll wait for the price to drop 10 cents, and then I'll buy it. Sure. But I didn't get anything, sadly, this week.
This week, I actually did buy something. Normally, it's the other way around. But I got the Fantastic Four, First Steps. Was so happy to get this. I still need Thunderbolts. I've been waiting to find the slipcover in good condition. But this slipcover is really nice. It's got a lot of good embossment on there. I actually really like the design of it. I like the Steelbook more.
It just
looks
so comic booky.
Yeah.
It's so nice.
It's great. I like the Steelbook, the one that you got. I like that a lot as well. So, excited to own that movie. I can't wait to rewatch it. But coming out this week on the 21st is Eddington. It's got the nice A24 exclusive barcode packaging on there. And then the X trilogy with X, Pearl, and Maxine. They're getting a little trilogy A24 set, which looks pretty cool. So if you don't have any of those movies, good time of year to buy that. And then a few older movies coming out on 4K. We have A History of Violence, The Place Beyond the Pines, which we mentioned earlier, Derek C. and France's movie, and then Clue and Eon Flux. I've never seen it. I've always been confused by the title. Eon. So there's that. I haven't seen that movie. But Eddington is one I'll definitely buy down the road. We actually had a really good discussion about that, but it's a tale of two halves, for sure.
Yeah, it's a very interesting movie. That's one that is in that Amazon shopping cart that I just mentioned where I'm like, fuck, I actually really enjoyed that movie. And I'll likely end up buying it here soon. I already own Place Beyond the Pines, so I probably won't grab that. But another October recommendation, Clue on 4K. Clue in general is a great movie. I feel like not a lot of people our age really talk about it. It was so fun to watch the first time I watched it. And then getting to the end and being like, oh, there's multiple endings. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure. Who do you want to be guilty? So watch Clue this October season. It definitely fits the spooky vibe, and it's a great film.
Moving into movie news, I wanted to mention this week the passing of somebody who you probably don't know the name of, but Drew Struzan, who is an artist behind some of the most classic movie posters of all time from the 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s. I'm just going to rip through a bunch of names and then kind of talk about them. But he did the posters for the Star Wars special editions when they came out in the 90s, and then the prequels of the Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Back to the Future, The Goonies, The Thing, Big Trouble in Little China, Blade Runner, Hook, the first couple Harry Potter movies, E.T., First Blood, Coming to America, Shawshank Redemption. A lot of really good movies. And there's so many more than that. I just kind of put a few on this list here. But, man, I was just looking through his catalog of work. He has a website that you can look through all of the posters he's done. And just the, beautiful hand-drawn art of those. Oh, yeah. Even though, a lot of them do have the kind of, the actors' faces on them.
Yeah, sometimes.
There's so much more care to it than just the Photoshop these days where it's like, I don't know, just put the big stars in the circle of big comic book people. He took time and care and put, you'll notice, in the bottom of the post, it's little scenes from the movie. He'll do just, a little drawing of it that under a character's face. I can't even pick a favorite because there's so many good ones. Back to the Future is so iconic. I love the Goonies poster of them hanging from the thing, and it's all the kids on there.
All of the most classic 80s movies posters he did.
The Thing,
yeah,
is incredible.
So that is my favorite, and I saw an interview. It kind of coincided with when it was announced that he passed away. I saw an interview that for that poster, for that movie, he didn't know anything about the premise of it. He just knew a winter horror film, basically. Mm-hmm. He knew the rough setup of it and not much more than that. And then he put together, I think, on a quick turnaround, like maybe a day or two, one of my favorite movie posters of all time. And for one of my favorite films of all time. So his influence is going to be far-reaching. His influence is something that we all grew up with, at least if you're a Star Wars fan, with the special edition like VHSs that I had in my house. I was like, holy shit. Like, he made art. Like, a film poster is, yes, it is a promo marketing material. Like, you're trying to get your name out there. Like, a lot of stuff now, today, we get just a collection of faces, like Corey mentioned. But he did it best. He put care. It was a deep appreciation for the film, for the work, for the actors, for everything that goes into the aspect of filmmaking. And he did a good job at showing us a sneak peek or a glimpse of what the story might be for that movie. You mentioned with like kind of like the little vignettes at the bottom of like scenes and stuff. And it's just, there's few posters or artists, I think, today where we're getting that attention to detail that highlights kind of the art form of, yeah, it is a marketing material thing. Like, it's a poster. You're trying to sell seats and sell tickets. But also, we can do this so well. So it's sad to see a legend that maybe many people might not know by name, but you see his work and you immediately know him. Mm-hmm. And you can see his style throughout his career. So it is definitely kind of a sad day to hear that, but also it's just like, damn, he made the posters for all the movies of my childhood, like yeah. All the great movies of the 80s. Do you have a favorite, maybe? Or
I think I'd maybe go Back to the Future, but it's so tough. Even like, I don't know, Coming to America, that's such a good poster. And the thing is like, the movie poster has become kind of a lost art of the art behind it, and not just the Photoshop, because
not just using it for marketing purposes.
A lot of times, like, it'll just be the floating heads of the big stars because that's in their contract that they have to be on the poster, whatever. But like, even like some of the good posters we get now are like, this is the IMAX version of the poster. This is the Dolby Cinema.
Yeah.
But it's not the main poster, because that's where it's like, well, the stars need to have their face on it, so we can't. We'll do a cooler poster for like a smaller one, but these were all the main posters for these movies, and they're so iconic and so great. I hope somebody can kind of pick up the legacy of this, because I would love to see this come back and studios be like just accepting this of like the thing where you don't have an actor's face on it.
Yeah.
And it's so recognizable, and is so like, if you've never seen the movie, you're like, what the fuck is that? Like, what's going on there? Yeah. It just draws you into the movie in a way that a lot of the posters now are just like, well, I feel like I can see a lot of the movie from this poster of the big, you know, Timothy Chalamet and Robert Downey Jr.'s face, or whoever it is, you know? So definitely a legend. It's just, I want to buy so many of his posters now and just like hang them up, because they're so beautiful to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is truly like a lost art of, it is a project in and of itself. Yes, it's attached to a movie that is a big project, but this piece of marketing material can be something so beautiful and so great and have a lasting legacy, if not sometimes more so than the movie. Like, I feel like I could run into people that haven't seen John Carpenter's The Thing, but recognize the poster and like stuff like that. So sadly, he will be missed. He was a legend of poster design, of artwork, and yeah, he'll be missed. Moving into a little bit of a trailer roundup, which the only like noteworthy trailer we really had this week was a complete surprise to me, as it came from director Sam Raimi, who has a special place in my heart, but it is for his new kind of quasi-horror thriller called Send Help, which is starring Dylan O'Brien and Rachel McAdams. It is about two colleagues that become stranded on a desert island and the only survivors of a plane crash. On this island, they must overcome past grievances with each other and learn to work together to survive, but ultimately it's a battle of wills and wits to make it out alive, and you get kind of good, like some almost double meaning in moments, or like, you might be trying to kill each other. Like, it's an interesting trailer. I didn't even know Sam Raimi really had a current piece of work that he was looking to put out, and I'm already sold just because, one, it is Sam Raimi, but also I like the cast. The trailer, I think, was effective enough for me, and I'm excited for what this premise could birth. It also could bring about a lot of formulaic shit, but I have a little bit more faith in Sam Raimi to give me something a little bit more special.
So I'm excited about the dynamic here of Dylan O'Brien being the boss, and Rachel McAdams kind of being like early on in the trailer, he's like going to fire her if she doesn't like hit a performance quota or whatever. So I like that. I like both these actors a lot. So seeing them in a movie is going to be really fun. And a nice, I think it's January it's coming out. Yep. So it'll be a nice January, like, big director putting out something good for sure. Also this week we had, you know, a lot of news about Paramount trying to buy out Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers reportedly turned down a bid from Paramount. It was around $20 a share. David Zaslav, who is the head of Warner Brothers, called that too low. And, you know, Skydance, they're trying to, Paramount Skydance are trying to acquire more stuff. They're trying to acquire Warner Brothers, HBO, all that stuff. Warner Brothers Discovery is looking to split into two different companies, which they were before, and now they want to do it again. Yeah. I don't know. It's all fucking weird. I don't know. I hope that this deal doesn't go through. I think we mentioned it a couple weeks ago, whatever, but I like having different studios and different flavors, different kind of franchises that they can each have, and different original movies, and directors' deals with studios, I think, is interesting, too. So, happy that this didn't go through, but I feel like it sort of is inevitable at some point.
That we'll hear, like, a final dollar amount that they're like, okay, fine, yeah, you can take us. Yeah, I'm interested to see kind of where that kind of IP ends up and where it lands. Based on their dealing of such. But in other news, we also got an update that I don't think anyone was really asking for, but I am a massive Jim Carrey fan, so I'm fine with this. But Jim Carrey is now attached to a Jetsons film, to star in a live-action Jetsons film for Warner Brothers, with Colin Trevorrow potentially in discussions to direct, which is also a wild pairing. But apparently Trevorrow and Joe Epstein are in talks to be writing the script. And this would make the first Jetsons feature film since the 90s animated film, and originally a show that aired in the 60s, but it's the classic series that is that space age kind of, honestly, what I almost said Fantastic, what Fantastic Four First Steps kind of capitalizes on, that kind of like new age, space age, futuristic, modern world. So, Corey, how do you feel about Jim Carrey being at the front of a Jetsons potential film?
You know, I grew up watching the Jetsons and the Flintstones. They were just kind of like back-to-back. I remember on
Boomerang.
TV. Yeah, Boomerang. I was trying to think of the name of it. Boomerang was fucking awesome. So I know, like, my parents grew up with the Jetsons and everything, so I just kind of grew up watching that. Jim Carrey could be fun. I don't know if we, like, is he George, the dad, or I don't think they said, really.
That's my guess. Probably. Like, yeah, he's probably just going to be the dad, the father role.
But, you know, I guess he's kind of unretired from acting again.
He's like, actually, I'm after Sonic Hedgehog 3, I'm back.
I'm in these family movies now, so it could be fun. A little box office news just with Black Phone, which we talked about earlier. Black Phone 2 opened to $27.3 million domestically, and, you know, it beat the opening of The Black Phone, the original movie, which had $23 million. And this actually is a pretty solid opening for a movie, because Black Phone 2 had a budget around $30 million. With marketing and all that, it's probably more like 60 or something. But a pretty solid start for the movie. And I think once it gets the worldwide totals and everything, and even once it's out of theaters, the ancillaries and streaming will make it a profitable movie, I hope, because, like we said, I think it's good. October's been a little rough box office-wise.
Yeah,
we started out like in September with Conjuring doing really well, and it had me hopeful, but end of September, October hasn't been great.
Especially Tron Ares.
Yeah, Tron Ares, which we both liked, but didn't do very well. Yeah, I don't know, and I don't know that anything this week is going to, like, blow the doors open. I hope Springsteen does good. I think that'll probably be number one, I would guess. Yeah. But go to the theater. Go support movies, please.
I feel like Black Phone 2 has a good potential to kind of continue building a good amount of wealth for these next couple of weeks. Hopefully Shelby Oaks makes a decent amount of money. I'm hoping at least, like, a couple million would be great.
Yeah.
But, it's horror time. Like, let's watch horror movies, so go support them in theaters. A piece of news that dropped today that was a pleasant surprise, because this is an actor that Corey and I both really love. Colman Domingo was announced to be cast as the Cowardly Lion for Wicked for Good. He's an Oscar-nominated actor. Maybe he should have been an Oscar-winning actor, depending on who you ask, which I probably would agree with you if you said yes, he should have won. But he will be voicing the Cowardly Lion for Wicked for Good. The casting was revealed on Instagram, I believe, of the official, like, Wicked Instagram, where Domingo was kind of being playful, and he said, "See you in Oz." So I'm really excited about that. I'm don't know how big of a character. I haven't seen the stage show. I don't know how much, like, Dorothy and the main crew of the Wizard of Oz are really in Wicked. So I don't know how much to expect from Colman Domingo, but I like that casting. I love Colman Domingo. I don't think it hurts to add him to literally anything. He is one of the best actors, I think, working today. So I like this. Wicked for Good is one of my most highly anticipated films for the rest of this year, for the entirety of 2025, actually. So I'm excited to see this, and you're adding talent to a movie I'm excited about, so I'm not going to complain.
Good casting, for sure. I unfortunately have had, like, a couple things spoiled of, like, where characters from Wicked, how they translate to Wizard of Oz things. I won't spoil it if you don't know. I was hoping to not know much about the second half, and I've had a couple of those things spoiled, which sucks. Okay. It's kind of unavoidable when people are talking about it, unfortunately. But, yeah, I mean, Colman Domingo, like you said, add him to anything. He's great. Sing Sing is one of the best movies of this decade.
100%.
Like, it's a damn near perfect movie, so go watch that if you haven't seen that.
Yeah, check out anything Colman Domingo's in. Sing Sing especially, though. And thanks again for joining us for another episode of Slate Night, the Film Fan Podcast. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok, where we post more in-depth movie reviews and some updates in terms of movie news. In the world of film, it's not just about what's on screen, it's also who's next to you in the theater.
For Mason and I at Slate Night, that's a wrap.